this is Justice Radio, a weekly show on WMPG with your host, Linda Small. And today we're talking with Daniel Rosen of the Coalition for Carceral Nutrition about the food we feed incarcerated people, its impact on health, and how we use food as harm rather than healing in our prisons and jails. But first, a little information about me. I'm Linda Small, a project coordinator with Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition and executive director of Reentry Sisters, an organization that specializes in helping women and girls return home from prison. And you can learn more about our website at Reentry Sisters. So today, this is part two, continuing our conversation about how to improve nutrition in prison and jails to create healthier and more cost-effective outcomes for everyone impacted, from the folks living in carceral spaces to taxpayers and policymakers. So welcome again, Daniel, and thank you for joining us today. Our last conversation, we ended off talking about evidence-based solutions and the data that we need for health. Can you tell us a little bit more about that, please?
I think, you know, what you said about health, I wanted to touch on for a moment. I think one of the problems is we don't tend to have good information around chronic health conditions that people are subjected to inside jails and prisons, especially the ones that they don't come in with. Sometimes jails and prisons will record that information when somebody comes in with chronic health conditions. They'll do an intake interview. But the ones that people develop when they're inside are not things that prisons and jails tend to report on. They may have their own internal reporting on it. They may have their own internal files on it. But it's not something that they are easily going to give up information about. And so we don't have good information about incidents of diet-related disease inside. It's one of the things that I think our organization is committed to tackling. I think we can't expect agencies to want to invest in nutrition unless we can show them that the healthcare costs are really eating their budgets alive. That information has got to be tracked. One, I think, bright spot in that is the potential expansion of Medicaid, especially into jails and prisons, and the Medicaid waiver process that's going on in a number of states right now. The more we have Medicaid involvement in jails and prisons, the more I think data and reporting that you're going to see required. And so it may offer us a little bit of a glimpse and a window into some of the diet-related disease information that we currently don't have in most carceral systems. So I think, you know, we have, as an organization, a lot of tasks on our plate. We have a lot of things we've set out for ourselves to do, whether it's on the information sharing side, the coalition building side, the advocacy side, and really even the facility and programmatic side of making some kinds of working with corrections agencies to make some changes. I think we have set all of those tasks for ourselves in terms of the organization. And if people want to learn more, sorry, I should have said before, carceralnutrition.org is the website. And I think, you know, be happy to answer any questions that folks have. There's a way to contact us there. But carceralnutrition.org is where we've started to grow our online presence. I appreciate the LinkedIn shout out, but I think the website is really what we're looking also to expand and to make sure that there are information resources there. And I think you'll get a sense there of what our agenda is. And it's not a small agenda, it's an ambitious agenda. We understand that all of this will take time to build, but I think all of these pieces are necessary. I don't, you know, including the advocacy and information sharing piece, I don't think we can hope to change the tray. And that is really has been our mantra, change the tray. I'm interested in, of course, in passing laws. I'm interested in policies. I'm interested in coalition building. But at the end of the day, what I want to do is change the tray. And I think that's what we're committed to. I don't think we'll change the tray until we change the conversation around the tray. Right. And the conversation has to be, I think, more understanding and more agreement that everybody deserves a healthy meal, and that feeding people in healthy and nutritious ways, even in the places that we don't like to pay attention to, even behind the walls of jails and prisons that is out of sight, that we have to do better when it comes to that if we care about public health, we care about community safety, if we care about people. And, you know, at the end of the day, if people don't care about those things, at least I hope they care about spending taxpayer dollars in wise ways, in ways that make sense. One of the things that I saw in the DC jail, where I spent about a year, was the massive amount of food waste involved. And we've surveyed people in the DC jail. There's a survey last year of about 300 people in the DC jail. We understand. I know just from my own eyes and from my own experience, but we also know from survey data that about half to two-thirds of the food is thrown away. People just aren't going to eat food that's unpalatable. They'll throw it straight in the trash can. Or you might take something off of a food tray and leave the rest. Mm-hmm. And so in DC's case, where we're spending a small budget compared to a lot of other corrections agencies, but about $6, $7 million a year to feed people, we're wasting two-thirds of that money. We're costing families, families who frankly can't afford it, to support people with commissary dollars. But we're also wasting tax dollars. We're costing public healthcare systems a lot of money on the back end by people who come home with chronic diseases. But we're literally throwing money up, just throwing it out the door by paying Aramark, in DC's case, $6, $7 million a year to feed people food that they're just going to throw away largely.
Yeah, that's such a great point. I know in Maine, tremendous amount of food waste. And even though the food isn't the best, they have a certain quantity that everybody gets. No one gets more, no one gets less. It's exactly what the measurement is based on the calorie count, quite frankly, not the quality of the calories, but the calorie count itself. And so I know in Maine, one of the issues that we used to have, particularly in the women's prison, is let's just say the morning meal had oatmeal, which can be generally healthy. But you didn't want any of the other stuff that was on that tray. And you wanted like maybe two helpings of oatmeal and none of the, you were going to throw everything out, just like you said. In Maine, we would rather throw out that leftover oatmeal than give you two helpings of a healthy choice, and just cut out the poor choices. So I'm very aware of food waste and how that can play into this evidence-based program that you're trying to create, because I think changing the tray is equal to changing the narrative, right? What are we saying about the food, and what does that say about the people, and what does that say about our society when we choose to weaponize food, is essentially, I think, what we're doing. So based on this conversation, you know, what would you say to our listeners? Why should the average person care about folks who are incarcerated and the food that we serve them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think in large part, if you look at, you know, articles in the popular press around food in carceral spaces, I always read the comments because the comments kind of amaze me. There's this idea that people in jails and prisons want to eat steak and lobster, that they think they, you know, deserve the best five-star meals. I don't think anybody that I met in jail or prison has the illusion that they are going to get a five-star meal or a restaurant quality meal or a, you know, steak and lobster. It's just, it's some kind of popular perception nonsense. I think what we should hope for is that we feed people in ways that don't harm them. That's a pretty low bar, but it would be a better bar than where we are now. I think it would be ideal if we fed people in ways that gave them some choice and some agency and some ability to make decisions for themselves. But I think people should care because people are coming home, and people come home sick now. People come home with, as far as we can tell, twice the incidence of many chronic diet-related diseases like diabetes, high blood pressure, heart disease. And these are, we're not talking about a few people, 650,000 people come home every year from prison. About 10 million people a year cycle through our nation's jails every year. These are not small numbers. These are numbers that have outsized impacts on public health systems, on health care costs, on people's on the public burden. And so people who come home from prison and jail tend to be on public assistance at far higher rates than other categories of people in the general population. And so they tend to tax those systems of public assistance in ways that affect everybody. And I think when we start to understand how bad it is, one of the difficult things I think always is getting visuals. Getting pictures of what food looks like in jail and prison is not an easy thing. A lot of times they come out of jails and prisons on contraband cell phones. But those visuals can be really impactful when people start to see how people are actually fed in jails and prisons, how bad it is. And when I use the term slop, that's not being melodramatic. I think a lot of people would look at the kinds of food trays that I've seen and eaten, and that's the word that comes to mind. Unidentifiable, mystery meat. You know, people don't understand, I think, just how bad it is. Green lunch meat, because it lunch meat that's obviously spoiled or on the verge of being spoiled. When we surveyed people in DC's jail, 70% of people had been served spoiled or rotten food. 7 in 10 people. And in fact, people who were there for more than a year, 8 in 10 people had been served spoiled or rotten food. And that's generally consistent with what Impact Justice has found nationwide in terms of food spoilage. You know, not a lot of people out here understand, I think, quite how bad food service has gotten in most jails and prisons.
You are listening to Justice Radio with your host, Linda Small, and today we're talking with Daniel Rosen of the Coalition for Carceral Nutrition about the food we feed incarcerated people, its impact on their health, and how we use food as maybe a system of harm instead of a system of healing. And
Were there
so,
food people? Yeah.
Yeah,
Go
no, I
ahead.
was just going to ask you, do you have any of those visuals on your website for people who want to learn more?
It's not a thing that we've tended to spend a lot of time putting on our website, collecting those images, but I think it's not a bad idea. It's, you know, those pictures can be impactful for folks to see just how bad it is. And I think people tend to see those images sometimes and think, oh, well, that's kind of an extreme case. And the reality is, those images that I, at least the ones that I've seen floating around, tend to be pretty typical.
Yeah, that's the norm, I think. To call it slop in some instances is generous. So if you had someone gave you a plate of food and you could not identify what that food is, would you eat it? Is the question. And that is a daily question for people who are incarcerated. And do you think all of this attitude and what we feed people and what is offered by large institutions on commissary, are we teaching people to eat poorly as well? These 10 millions who are going to cycle through the system?
I think a lot of people go into jails and prisons when they're young, and they tend to take home with them those patterns of eating. But a lot of people, you know, I think we have to also admit and understand that people come into jails and prisons with unhealthy food habits. That is for sure part of the picture. We also have to, I think, acknowledge that, especially in jails, people are stressed. And when people are stressed, they tend to turn towards comfort foods and things they're familiar with. And that's not always fruits and vegetables. It can be cookies and chips and the kinds of comfort foods that anybody eats, whether they're incarcerated or not. So I think we have to acknowledge that a nutrition education piece that folks tend to do better when they know better. And I think the younger people are, maybe the less that they're focused on their health and nutrition. I think when you get into your 30s and 40s and 50s, you start to understand the impacts that nutrition can have on your overall health, for a lot of people. Not everybody, but I do think it's a problem for younger folks, who tend to be a little bit more thoughtless about what they eat, and may not have developed good habits at home when they were young in terms of health and in terms of nutrition and food. Even understanding that, I think we have to do better for folks and at least give them the choice to eat healthy, and give them the opportunity to do that if it's something that they want to do. Commissaries, tend to have 15 kinds of cookies and 20 kinds of potato chips and one kind of health mix or trail mix. The healthiest items on commissary tend to be the most expensive by weight. And the chips and the ramen and the unhealthiest items tend to be the cheapest items. So when we set up a system like that, I think we're setting people up to fail. And even if they have the education and want to make the right choices, we make it economically difficult for them. But I do think nutrition education is part of the puzzle here, and we have to give folks some knowledge about the nutrition piece too.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point. We haven't really talked about juvenile detention centers. But I
Sure.
would imagine, right, that the children are facing similar food issues that adults do, right? Especially when we're talking about developing brains and bodies and simply not giving them the nutrition that they need.
That's right. And I think juvenile detention centers are, for me and for us, an obvious place to look to corrections administrators for to do better, and to work with us to reform the food service. They tend to have all of the same vendors and corporations involved in institutional food service in those kinds of juvenile facilities. They're usually smaller than most any jail and prison. So I think that's an opportunity to work with them. It's a little bit easier or a little bit less expensive to maybe make changes in a juvenile detention facility where the numbers are just lower. But I think even in a lot of jails, we have a very high number of younger folks. I know just my experience in the DC jail, there's a lot of kids in there. I mean, even if they're not minors, they're 18, 19, 20, at an age when, as you said, people are still developing, their brains are still developing, when good nutrition we know is really important. And I think we tend to ignore the fact that kids, whatever age limit you want to put on that, kids are different, and that they require better nutrition. And I think it's an area where maybe we can get some more common ground, and some more agreement that we have to do better when it comes to food and nutrition, particularly with kids.
Yeah,
You
we
know,
it,
I we care, you know, if a 16-year-old is in school, we tend to care what they're eating for school lunch.
Yeah.
And there are whole communities of interest and advocacy efforts around school lunch. And I think, you know, some of the energy in the carceral space comes from that, those advocates, same advocates. But a 16-year-old in a juvenile detention facility, you know, that's someone's son also, or someone's daughter also. And so we can't just ignore the fact that they're behind a wall, and therefore we don't have to care about what they eat and how healthy they are.
Yeah, I agree. I know in Maine, we have a horrific system, juvenile system. Long Creek Juvenile Facility is still open. And although the count of the number of girls and boys who are in there, our youngest is 11 years old, 11. And I can't think of a possible reason why an 11-year-old would be incarcerated. But since the scale of the number of children have gone down and the overhead remains, it turns out that we spend a half a million to $500,000 a year per child to incarcerate them in that facility. And so when I think about that, gee, we could send that kid to college. We could buy them their first house. We could make sure that they had the education on health and nutrition, and reacclimation into society, get them their mental health needs, all of those types of things with that sort of price tag. We're paying it anyway. So I think you're right. I think, starting out at a juvenile center might garner a little bit more support because we're talking about kids here. Although I must add that, the adults who are incarcerated are someone's child too, right? They're someone's dad or mom or brother or sister. So we are talking about community members here. And I think we each need to decide for ourselves just how much we want to be part of a community and help our fellow brothers and sisters.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, somebody cares about each and every one of those people, whether they're adults or juveniles. There are people out there who care about those people who are part of the community, and those folks themselves are part of the community. We have, an active, very active conversation in DC around food insecurity and food deserts, particularly in underserved parts of the city. The jail sits right in the middle of it. And it's as if it's this little island that we're not talking about because it's hidden behind a wall. We talk about this, at great length in certain circles in DC about food security issues, and nutrition security issues. And yet it's almost as if we're going to ignore this little island that sits in the middle of it just because it's behind a wall. Well, that wall, I got to tell you, it's permeable, and people are coming in and out to the community. And as you said, somebody's brother, somebody's sister, somebody's father or mother. And I think it's amazing to me how much we spend to incarcerate people, especially youth, especially older people with health problems. We spend ungodly sums of money, hundreds of thousands of dollars per person, like you said. So little of that goes to actually taking care of them. So much of it goes to just systems of control and not systems of care. And so I'm not under the illusion that those systems of control are going away, but if we invested a little bit more in the care side, I think it would serve all of us a little bit better.
Yeah, I agree. We tend to criminalize care in the system, and it shows up in various ways. So we have time for one last question. And so if you need volunteers to help with your numerous goals that you mentioned, what advice can you give people out there who are listening? How should they get involved?
Yeah, thanks for that. And especially as we, I think about the holidays and think about family and think about gathering with family around food, especially. I think, we have a lot of opportunities for folks to get involved in local food systems. Folks may not see themselves getting involved in carceral food systems. Carceral food systems tend to exist behind high walls. But getting involved in local food systems and I think advocating for healthier local food systems, robust local food systems, local food systems that are connected to carceral spaces, I think that's one of the things that we can do a lot better, right? As you said, getting local growers and local producers more involved in what are ultimately communities, local communities. And a lot of carceral spaces exist in very rural areas, areas where growers and producers are more prevalent. And so I think we have an opportunity to connect carceral spaces to local food systems a a lot better than we're doing right now. And so I think any involvement that people can get in those local food systems and advocating for connecting them to carceral spaces is a win. I think we have, one of the things I like to talk about what success looks like. One of the things I think we will know we are more successful when corrections agencies go to or go back to in-house cooking and scratch cooking. And I think that's only possible when they're supplied locally, and when they're supplied with fresh items from local growers. It's very hard to do, I think, without that part of the equation. And so I think it's critical. Connections to local food systems is critical for carceral spaces. And I think, when we get corporate actors out and we take profit motives out of carceral food systems and make those kitchens more serving food that's cooked in-house and produced locally, we will have achieved some measure of success.
That's wonderful. Thank you. And I think the final point you just made that is really an important connection is how these carceral food systems are driven by capitalism, right? We're not helping out our local community growers or our local grocer. We are helping these very large, often international organizations who could care less about, right, some family in Maine or a family in Ohio or anything of that nature. So I think that's a wonderful point to end on. And, I'm just kind of blown away by today's conversation. And I think our listeners have learned a great deal about carceral nutrition and health and piqued their interest enough to go to your website, the Coalition for Carceral Nutrition. So thank you, Danielle, for sharing your insights into how food is used inside jails and prisons as a form of punishment and neglect, right? That often causes ill health and drives healthcare costs even higher, right?
Yeah,
And
thanks very
people,
much. Yeah.
thank you. So, listeners, we have some exciting new shows coming to Justice Radio. We're going to explore some criminal legal issues and processes in Maine. We're going to talk about what it's like to be arrested or arraigned or go through the court system. What does it mean to plea bargain or go to trial? And how do our sentencing laws impact the lives of Mainers and so much more? So visit the Justice Radio show page on WMPG.org for archived episode aired on WMPG, WERU, and WNHB. And a big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode.